Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It used to be said that you are what you eat. In 21st century America, it would seem the new maxim is you are what you buy. But who controls what you buy and what your purchases mean to you? While some argue that brand managers and advertisers hold most of the power to influence our consumer choices, my guest today would argue that we buyers have more power over the identity of brands than we might imagine. Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Rob, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
We have to start, I guess, with this concept of the desire code, which is the result of rational needs overlaid by less than rational desires, which are very often influenced by how a product is marketed to us. Can you explain how it works?
Yeah, well, in the background of this is that I talk in the book about something called the pretty good problem, which is just the general idea that there are, I think that I mentioned in particular the example of kitchen stoves that Consumer Reports looked at, and they evaluated 53 different kitchen stoves, and they found that all of them were either good, very good, or excellent.
They all cook your food, basically.
So that, and they all work, and they all work pretty well. So that, unfortunately, that sounds great, but it really complicates things for both people who are trying to sell stoves and for people who are trying to buy stoves, because how do you tell the difference? Well, one of the answers to that is this process that we refer to as branding, which is this idea or this process of attaching an idea to a thing. And in the case of stoves, I mentioned the Viking stove. You've probably heard of this sort of high-end range of ranges. And, you know, what they seem to manage to do, they didn't actually do that great in the Consumer Reports. They sort of fell in the middle, even among high-end stoves. But they managed to attach this idea, this emotional and extra-rational set of ideas to their product, and they did it, as you alluded to, in collusion with consumers. Consumers had a lot to do with that. That added to those rational things and created this other bond that broke through the pretty good problem and cracked this thing that I'm calling the desire code.
So in other words, people want them because they feel like a chef when they're cooking on a Viking stove looking at one.
The interesting thing about it is there's various theories, and I was reading one that was suggesting that it's an expression of your personal style and your creativity and so on, which is all very interesting until you learn that a shockingly high percentage of Viking ranges installed in homes are actually never cooked on.
So they look good when people come over.
Yeah, they look good when people come over, or my argument really is that instead of it being necessarily about impressing strangers, it's in a weird way, it's about impressing yourself. It's about whatever story you're kind of telling yourself about who you are. I think we are our own primary audience for a lot of our consumer decisions.
Now, obviously, Rob, you think about brands and about the way we use them for a living, but some of this thinking that you express in the book was triggered by Nike's announcement that it was going to buy the Converse brand. And you had figured that you didn't use brands for your personal identity until you really thought about this particular issue.
And odds are good that someone's going to call in to this show later and say that they are not affected by brands and advertising and all that. I was definitely that person, and I was that person for professional reasons in the sense that, look, I'm an observer, I'm objective, I'm not participating in this, I'm chronicling it, doesn't affect me. If there's anybody who should see through this stuff, it's me. Brands don't mean anything to me. Well, then Nike bought Converse, and Nike had been a brand that, although I have a lot of respect for them as a business story, it's just not a brand that I would personally wear. I find the swoosh a little bit pushy and sort of, it's everywhere, and I don't want to be a part of it. I had always been aware of Converse sneakers without ever having given it any conscious thought that I can recall. I don't remember waking up one day and saying, my rebel heroes wear Converse, ergo I will wear Converse. However, I realized that I was now having this crisis that, well, can I continue to wear Converse if it's owned by Nike? And I was having this sort of existential dilemma about the meaning of this brand that I'd been wearing and whether I could continue to participate in it. And that was when I abruptly realized I wasn't above all this stuff after all. It was affecting me too. And that had a big impact on my decision to write the book and the way that I approached it.
Why do you think we find it so hard to acknowledge? And we've done sort of similar themes before, and we do always have people calling in and saying, well, I'm not influenced by brands, but my brother-in-law, you should see that guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why is it that we don't believe that we use them to communicate identity?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is that in general, and this is just basic psychology, we all tend to think that we're better drivers than everyone else, and that we're better, you know, we're smarter than everyone else, and that we're less susceptible to manipulation than everyone. It just sort of fits in with that. The second thing is that I think we're kind of conditioned to see brands and to see commercial culture as somehow just not that important. It just seems sort of trivial. And it's the thing you recognize in your brother-in-law, but that you would never participate in. Now, there are good reasons to take it seriously, because the impact in the real world is real. And to me, I mean in terms of, you know, the ecology and so on, we know, and in our personal satisfaction, we know that our consumer decisions actually matter. And to me, the worst way you can approach the marketplace is by thinking that you're above it all and that none of it is having any impact on you.
Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. So you've coined this term murketing, which is a hybrid of murky and marketing. How does that work?
Well, this related to the tendencies that we were just talking about, there's been a tremendous amount of cultural noise in the last, sort of in the period that I was writing the book and before that, suggesting that because of new technologies, TiVo, the Internet, and so on, consumers have more power and control than they've ever had. This could, you know, all boiling down to Time magazine deciding that you were the person of the year in 2006. Well, those things are all true in a way. But those technology changes have also, in a funny way, empowered marketers. And what I mean by that is that they now have a heavy incentive to get beyond the 30-second commercial, and they've certainly done it by using a wide range of tactics that we might not recognize as marketing, ranging from something as basic as product placement in a show to something I talk about in the book of a brand called Axe, which is a deodorant and body spray brand aimed at young men, have built everything from websites that you forward to your friends, and in one case created a show basically for MTV called Game Killers. So you can't really TiVo past that particular piece of marketing because it's the whole show. So this is what I'm talking about, of the line getting murkier between branding and essentially everything else.
Well, and the Axe strategy is so interesting because their commercials are ridiculous, and everybody who sees them knows they're ridiculous. They show basically beautiful young women taking off their clothes when they smell a man wearing this deodorant. And even no teenager or 20-something is unaware that this is silly, but they work.
Absolutely, yeah. And they're transparently preposterous. And I remember when I was talking to someone involved in the marketing for it, and he was saying, well, you know, if you're going to build a brand these days, and that's in the United States, that's a relatively recent brand. It's been built in this new era, this new post-TiVo era. And he said, well, you don't really want to spend your time trying to sell the functional benefits of the deodorant. You don't want to waste people's time by saying it lasts longer and this kind of thing. And it's like, well, it's deodorant. I mean, how else are you going to sell it? And the answer was, well, you sell it as pop culture. And it seems stunning that we could have a society in which a deodorant brand could be part of pop culture, but there you have it.
It's almost like those silly Mentos commercials that looked all sort of odd and not typical of American commercials.
A lot of what advertisers are trying to do is create this kind of talk value. They're trying to be part of culture and be something that's in your head. And a way to get in your head is to be something that you're talking about, you're forwarding the email to your friends. And to go back to the earlier theme, I think that a lot of the technology changes that have empowered us as consumers have also empowered marketers and made those kinds of conversation starters far easier for them to achieve than they would have been just by running a 30-second ad.
What motivates brand evangelizers, these people who want all their friends to buy the same things that they've purchased?
The main thing that motivates them, I think, is human nature. And I suppose that it's probably always been true that, A, we've trusted the opinions of our friends, and, B, that there's a thing called the endowment effect where we just tend to value if it's something that I've gone out and bought, I'm probably going to feel good about it and want to talk about it for a while anyway. And that's all basic human nature. What's new and that's happened in this sort of marketing era is that firms have sprung up that have figured out how to channel and sort of stoke and increase that kind of word of mouth talk by, say, sending you some products so that you're the first one on your block. And as long as the product's pretty good, which because of that pretty good problem earlier, there's a decent chance it will be, you know, the value of it, of you being the first on your block to have it, really only works if you can talk it up and get other people to participate in the same thing, or as they call it, evangelizing for the product.
And so people feel good about the fact that they're kind of an influence leader among their friends.
Yeah, and I don't think that they're thinking of it in any nefarious terms. It seems like you're doing your friends a favor. You're telling them about something, and here's some new information that you didn't have, and I sure do love. And, you know, we all know someone who, whether they've gotten it from a word-of-mouth agency or not, they get a new cell phone, and they can't stop talking about how great their new cell phone is. And they're really talking to themselves on some level and reassuring themselves, but they're also, I think, subtly hoping to influence you, and that if you follow along and say, "Yeah, you know, Bill, I bought one of those cell phones too, thanks to your advice," then let's face it, you kind of feel good about that.
And you point out that we're most likely to notice ads for things that we have already purchased.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing, and I think that relates to this, that it's just a salience factor on some level that you're going to key into it and say, "Ah, that's something that I recognize." But second, I do think that we're kind of open to convincing ourselves. It goes back to that earlier observation that I really think that something that people need to understand is that our primary audience for much of our behavior, it is not about impressing the Joneses. It's about impressing yourself.
To what extent, Rob, do you think that all of this is a generational phenomenon?
Well, there's two ways to go at that. Obviously, every generation grows up with slightly different technology, and every generation grows up for the last 100 years in an increasingly commercialized world. And there's no escaping the power of brands in the lives of some of younger people because they've just been exposed to it more often. It has more social currency and so on. The related thing, though, that isn't new, that's true always with young people, is young people are always in the process of forming an identity. And brands have a role in that process, probably more of a role than ever. But we do tend to get a little bit less susceptible to it, hopefully, as we age and we figure out who we are. But the curveball in all this is that because society right now is so youth-obsessed, we all want to feel like we get what the young people are up to and that we don't want to miss out on what the young people understand. So that makes it a little bit more confusing to totally generalize on a generational basis.
Well, and what's so interesting is this idea that brands allow us to say different things about ourselves, contradictory things about ourselves. And you point out that the seeds of that in some ways are sown in childhood when we use play to sort of try on different identities.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's just a natural part of, that's always a natural part of growing up. What's a less a natural part of growing up, and there are other writers who have addressed this more thoroughly than I have, is the degree to which brands have insinuated themselves into that process, and it's hard to escape at this point.
Rob Walker is my guest. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rob Walker, who writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I guess, Rob, authenticity has always been a sort of slippery concept in advertising and sales and marketing. But it really gets complicated when you start to look at it in this respect. Certain brands communicate things or seem to communicate things about us and who we are that may have no relationship whatsoever to the foundation of the brand itself. Would you talk, for example, about Ralph Lauren and the Polo brand that was so big, particularly in the 80s and the 90s?
Sure. Well, I compare Polo in the book to Echo, which is a sort of urban associated brand, hip-hop associated brand, and you know, that's a particular culture that is kind of obsessed with ideas about authenticity. But when you peek back behind the curtain of Echo, the guy who created it really had no particular connection to hip-hop. He really wasn't a graffiti artist, sort of learned about that stuff in coffee table books. He was, you know, a well-meaning guy and an authentic fan, I suppose, but he didn't have any of what you would call street cred. And it sounds like, well, that's just incredible. How could that happen? But then I point out that Ralph Lauren, who was not a sort of a patrician figure who came from a WASP background, quite the opposite. And nevertheless, he forged this vision of what we would now call WASP-like sort of style, I guess, that he defined that entire aesthetic. And if you look behind the curtain, it doesn't really matter who's standing there. This is what I mean when I talk about it being a dialogue and consumers having a big role in it, is the real decisions about what succeeds in the marketplace and about what it means is always a collaboration, always has been a collaboration between who's making it and who's buying it. And in the case of both Echo and Polo, those things were a dialogue that emerged to create the meaning that we are familiar with now. And when that doesn't happen, nothing takes off in the marketplace without our consent.
Yeah, and I would have to imagine a lot of the people buying Echo products and Polo products didn't have either an urban or a patrician background, but wanted to sort of buy into that.
Yes, I think that that's right. And it became, in a sense, a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. It's partly done through advertising, but it is done through who's wearing it and what context we see it in and how it becomes kind of acceptable in our lives.
One of my favorite factoids in the book is the fact that Ramones t-shirts outsell Ramones albums 10-1.
Yeah, well, this is something I bring up whenever people talk about, you know, if they resist the idea that logos have meaning, then I tend to bring up band logos, because for some reason people seem to be more willing to play along with that as something that means something. But, you know, as a symbol, that Ramones logo that's on Ramones t-shirts, it has so much cultural power. It just has a shorthand meaning for, you know, immediately whether you're the kind of person who would wear a Ramones t-shirt, and your reasons for that might be different. But it's pretty interesting that those reasons can apparently become completely disconnected from, say, owning a lot of Ramones records.
Maybe just the greatest hits and you're done and you can buy the t-shirt.
Yeah. If that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Roger in Dallas. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I have a question for your guest. Is the opposite also true? If I've boycotted Dow Chemical since they made napalm for the Vietnam War, or ExxonMobil because of the Valdez. I mean, does that fit in this theory?
In terms of your identity, by not buying these products.
Right, boycotts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I talk about this some in the book, that when people talk about consumer power, a lot of times what they mean in the internet era is complaining on a blog or something like that. But the ultimate form of consumer power is, in fact, not buying something, whether it's for an ideological reason or just in the case of, I talk about the new Coke, when that came out, it was a short dialogue between consumers and the company. The consumers said no thanks, and that was kind of the end of it. And, I mean, to me, what you decide to buy and what not to buy should be a reflection of some thought and some set of ideas, as opposed to a a shorthand quest for a thought or idea. And it's often much more compelling when it leads you to make a decision about what you're not buying and what you won't participate in. So what I try to argue in the book is that the right way to approach this is to have what you buy reflect who you are, and not the other way around.
Well, New Coke is such an interesting example because the people who boycotted and refused to buy it and embraced, you know, what became temporarily Coke Classic, talked about the taste of the product, but it arguably was really about the image of the product changing and the logo changing and the font changing. And maybe that was what people were arguing against.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had done extensive taste test. The new taste of it was heavily tested and preferred in blind taste test. That's why they did it. They thought that it was, in a lot of ways, a response to the whole Pepsi Challenge thing. But it turned out that there was something going on in the consumer mind there that had nothing to do with the intrinsic property of the liquid, and that just people didn't want it to change.
We have an email from Steve in Fort Worth who asks about logos on stadiums. He says, how do they fit into the discussion, and do they succeed as a tactic?
Yeah, they fit into the discussion in that a huge part of the point of all forms of advertising and branding is just to get a name into your head. And the theory on stadium advertising, stadium name right buying, is that it makes you say the name of the stadium over and over again when you're in, it works it into millions of conversations. It would be difficult to recreate that. How effective is that? I think that it would be impossible to really measure the effectiveness of it in a one-to-one way. No one, I think, ever says, hey, I'm going to a game at the Staples Center, and then the other person says, Staples, now that's a fine store, and heads over. That's never happened. But much of advertising, marketing, and branding happens on a non-conscious level, so you can't rule out the idea that, it's just a big struggle for space in your head, basically. And how they get that space in your head, if it comes from you having a conversation about where the game is tonight, they'll take it.
So many of us have heard plenty of examples of really active brand management by corporations. I think what's really fascinating in the book is this idea that sometimes management strategy for a brand involves either doing very little or the appearance of doing very little. You got the Red Bull people to admit that it's good for them, that people assume that their marketing efforts are really sort of cheap and under the wire.
Yeah, well, when they were coming into the U.S. market, they were already a big brand overseas, but they were totally unknown here, and they took a completely untraditional tactic. Instead of announcing themselves with 30-second ads and, time during the Super Bowl, all that kind of stuff, they were trying to present themselves as a kind of almost underground or at the very least underdog phenomenon, and they were spending tremendous amounts of money doing it, but they were spending that money on these very memorable and strange events that I talk about in the book. Going to kiteboarding to Cuba was one that I went down to observe in Florida. But they wanted to have part of their vibe that they were trying to create, their image they were trying to create, was it was kind of a, for a while anyway, it was like sort of a best-kept secret. It was something to be in on, and thus, of course, something to talk about. and it wouldn't have helped their image to be known to be in fact a massive company with tremendous amounts of money to throw around.
And there are times when the best image that a company can have is that of being completely non-corporate and the underdog, even as they continue to grow.
Yeah, definitely. And the weirdest case study along those lines, I think, in the book is the story of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, which was given this kind of underground image, essentially, or a sort of underdog image, I should say, this kind of anti-brand image, essentially by consumers. It started in Portland and with bike messengers, basically. It had very specific origins. And the company had absolutely no idea what was going on or why it was happening or who these people were. It wasn't as consumer they were after. And they had to kind of figure out how to react to it. And they did what, in retrospect, turned out to be a very clever thing, which was, for as long as they could, keep a rather low profile in terms of their involvement in giving these bike messengers some money to throw bike polo tournaments in the park, which is another reporting adventure that I went. I'll go to bike polo in Portland is how far I'll go to get these stories.
Well, it's hard to believe that the Pabst Blue Ribbon people had the foresight not to overdo it? Because it would seem as if, you know, having been a not hugely successful brand and suddenly getting this little buzz, that they would have hired some big firm that came rushing in and tried to capitalize on that small amount of success.
One of the underrated examples, I think I do point this out, that one of the advantages they had in a lot of ways was they really didn't have any money. So that probably helped them in an indirect way. They had some clever people there who said they talked about doing a lot of traditional things like putting some ads on alternative radio or whatever. And they had some people there who said, no, that's the last thing we should do. But probably that decision was helped by the fact that they really didn't have the budget.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Another one of the examples of a brand that has done some unusual things is Scion. These kind of boxy, I don't know if you'd call them vans, made by the same corporation that makes Toyotas?
Yeah, it's this Toyota brand. And when the Scion brand launched, they, unlike a PBR, very explicitly set out to create this kind of new image for this brand. And for a long time, they didn't want you to mention that it was related to Toyota because they wanted it to somehow be perceived as something independent. And they didn't even really seem to care at the beginning whether you knew it was a car. They just wanted you to like the brand Scion. So they were throwing these parties and, you know, they would get DJs and do these crazy events in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, always at the very most cutting-edge club. And then they kept expanding it outward. They were giving out CDs. They were sort of seen as a supporter of underground culture in a way. That was the way that they established themselves. And the fact that there was a car involved was sort of incidental, but it ended up that became the image of the car, that it was this kind of creative outsider supporting artists on the cutting edge brand, which did seem to work with a segment of younger consumers. And maybe even more important, seemed to just give the car a kind of sheen that it would have been hard to have without all that image making going around it.
Yeah, which is so amazing because if you look at these, they don't contain any of the elements that in the past have been used to market to young people. They don't seem sort of sporty, and they're nothing like a race car. They're just different, but it worked brilliantly.
Yeah, and, you know, they talk about, well, they're very customizable and this kind of thing, but the truth is that a lot of that, as far as I could tell, was not that different than you can get different options on any car. The markups seem to be awfully high on a lot of the on a lot of the Scion extras, but it was largely just an idea attached to go back to that branding thing. It was an idea that was attached to this particular car, and it seemed to take.
Of course, there's always going to be a certain segment of the population that wants things that are not recognizable brands. Mm-hmm. And now marketers are recognizing that and sort of creating brands that appeal to people who don't want anything of a brand.
Yeah, and, you know, to some extent, American Apparel does this in terms of just not having a logo, a very basic step. And, you know, it's a real urge. And one of the things that was a surprise to me in reporting the book that I hadn't set out to find but ended up finding when I was talking to young people was this, that they are creating brands of their own increasingly. A lot of very clever, very smart young people. I talk about some T-shirt branders who they live up to the stereotype of rejecting the mainstream brands, but they are responding to it by creating brands of their own. And when you talk to them about it, it's almost like you are talking about a band like the Ramones or something. Like, we got together, one's called the Hundreds, and they call themselves Ben and Bobby Hundreds, and it sounds all very cool. And you almost want to say, where's your record? But they don't have a record. They just have a brand.
What about the whole DIY movement? There are people knitting things and making crafts with beads, things that could be sort of obtained mass-produced, but there's a cachet to buying things from these sort of micro-distributors.
This is very related to that sort of brand, underground brand thing, I think, in that it's a from-the-grassroots movement made up of a lot of young people who they're creating and selling things. A lot of it is done through a website called Etsy.com. It's an easy place to get a really easy glance at it, and there's 70 or 80,000 people selling on there now, and I think they've passed a million mark in a number of consumers who bought from it. So it's a real phenomenon. What was interesting about it to me, and it's one of the reasons I kind of use it toward the conclusion of the book, is that there does seem to be an actual ideology involved to some extent of the value of hand-making things, the value of knowing who you're buying something from and how it was made, being able to ask them questions about the materials. It gets at a lot of the questions that really do matter to a lot of us as consumers, but that are very hard to answer in the traditional marketplace. And I think that these people have a real shot at least on some level, changing the dialogue around consumer behavior in a much more productive way than a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, which is, you know, fun stuff, but the idea that Pabst is a rebel brand is silly, and it doesn't have any real-world impact. But how things are made and what the consequences of the labor is and the consequence of the material, those are real issues that we really do care about and that get kind of short-circuited and shoved aside in a lot of traditional branding.
Well, a significant proportion of, say, hippies grew into yuppies, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years later. Is there reason to believe that this phenomenon is something more lasting than that?
Oh, I think that there is, partly because I think that I don't think of it as being a sort of, I don't want to be down on the hippies or anything, but I don't think that there's any particular, you know, utopian aspect to this. It's very much it's a response to the marketplace within the marketplace. And I think that that's what's interesting about it, is there's no naivete involved in this. It's taking it directly into the marketplace.
Rob Walker is my guest. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can join us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rob Walker. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. If you want to join us, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Does this new reality affect the way that companies deal with bad publicity about their products?
Sure. I think that the one thing the internet has definitely changed is that bad news can at least appear to snowball very quickly, and that is solved by many companies by simply getting involved themselves, or often what happens, you know, is that companies respond with yet more image making, and it's not exactly an issue of companies getting in trouble, but in companies responding to the sort of general consumer desire for earth-friendly, green-friendly products, this is mainly what we've seen, is a tremendous amount of image making. And it's what makes your trip to the supermarket now so confusing, when every product on the shelf now suddenly seems to have some virtuous aspect. And if they can't say it's green, then they'll say, well, we give a portion of proceeds to some good cause, or at least it's all natural, or something along those lines. And I think that that's, you know, in some ways it's just more of the same. It's unfortunate that it makes the marketplace even more confusing and disconcerting, I think, for us when we're trying to make the decisions about what's really important.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Rick in Frisco. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest came across the idea or found anything when researching his book if people are maybe turning toward branding and commercialism as a way of simply exercising what would normally be a political process that they just don't have faith in anymore, that they're more likely to get their point across in the marketplace than trying to change laws and that sort of thing?
Well, in a funny way, the PBR story had a kind of an almost political sort of element to it. And yeah, I mean, I do think that the thing is about branding and its ubiquity in the culture now is that these symbols do have some kinds of meaning for us, and whether it has to do with community or individuality or whatever, they're very available and they're very easy to obtain. It's a lot easier to sort of feel like you're, and actually these environmental related things we were just talking about, that it's there's a huge amount of effort right now being put into this idea that, well, if you're concerned about the planet, then what you should really do is buy these 50 products, you know, and that becomes a much easier way of getting involved in what I would say is a more political issue and a policy issue. It's much easier to get involved and to feel like you've done something by, whatever, buying a special cloth bag than it is to write your congressman about something.
Do you notice any trend that political candidates are being branded in a way that makes them more like a product these days than like a sort of a symbol of ideology?
Well, this is an issue that goes back a ways. People have been saying the president's being sold like snowflakes and so on. Someone else wrote something today in Salon that actually talked about Barack Obama in the context of marketing and of the, what I talk about in the book, of being a sort of symbol that other people are reading a variety of meanings into, and maybe those meanings don't add up. Now, I can't necessarily endorse that point of view, but I think that it's a pretty interesting way to go in terms of thinking about how politics and politicians play in this new sort of more fragmented marketing era.
Well, it's interesting, too, in that people use political advertising and, you know, T-shirts and campaign signs and bumper stickers as a way of sort of branding themselves because they assume, I would think a lot of people assume that having a sign out in front of your yard says something about who you are.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine that anyone's actually influenced by yard signs, right? I mean, what is the real purpose of those things? And it is definitely sort of a declaration of, it's an identity-type declaration. And clearly you're proud of it, and maybe you hope that it'll have some kind of influence on somebody, but I would argue that it's yet another case of our primary audience for our behavior being ourselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Shannon in Arlington. Hey, Shannon.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you very much. I was wondering if you could tell me the psychological aspect, the relationship between the pricing and the consumers. Because I was told whether you buy electronics or clothing materials or products, a lot of times it comes from the same manufacturer, but when it hits the market and it reaches the people, the same material may be sold $100 or $200 per item to a rich person, and then $5 or $10 to a poor person. So how does that work? Is it really true? And if it is, how does that work? What's the psychological aspect of it?
Well, there's a really interesting study that I talk about in the book that I think gets at this, and we were talking about Red Bull earlier, and they looked at energy drinks, and they measured the effectiveness of energy drinks on these. The subjects were doing puzzles, and the idea was that first they were exposed to information about, here's this energy drink, it improves mental alertness, now do this puzzle, and they divided them into two groups, and one group was told that this thing costs $2. And the other group was told it costs $2, but the university gets it at a discount, so it's only 89. We got it for 89 cents. The interesting thing was that the people who drank the $2 cans way outperformed on the puzzles the people who drank the 89-cent cans. Now, the cans weren't told that there was anything wrong with the stuff, so clearly not only is that the placebo effect, it's sort of like the placebo effect squared. And what the researchers concluded, a little cheekily, was that you really do get what you pay for, and that it not only affects perception, but that it affected, in this case, the actual effectiveness of the energy drink.
You have to wonder how that affects, you know, the $4 prescriptions that so many of the big mega retailers are now providing as sort of a loss leader to get people into their pharmacies.
This researcher actually who was involved in this, Dan Ariely, who has a book out called Predictably Irrational, talks specifically about this. I'm not sure if it's in his book or some subsequent study where he raises some really interesting questions about this very issue of how those findings can apply to prescription drugs. Yeah,
we had him on the show. He was terrific. Can you talk about the idea that we actually are creating communities, sometimes deliberately, through what we buy? When you first think about that, it comes across as sort of distastefully shallow.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. We have these sort of it is something. If brands are cultural symbols, then there is on some level something to be said for the idea that if a bunch of Ramones fans have something in common, then maybe a bunch of Apple fans do too. I'm not sure that I totally would go along with all that, and that brand communities really pass muster as true communities in the sense that. It's not like belonging to the neighborhood association where you really have a common set of things at stake. It's really just an identity matter. But there is such a powerful yearning for community, and I think this goes back, it's related to that political question from a minute ago, that it's another area where we can, because brands are so easily available to us, we can kind of get that feeling of community through brands.
Yeah, the biggest hazard in all of this, as you sort of define it, is that we can use brands to reflect our identities, and that's okay. But when we use them to build our identities, that becomes problematic.
It becomes problematic for exactly the reason that we're getting at here, which is that a brand can't truly deliver on. It can't really make you an individual. It can't. It doesn't really represent a belief system. It doesn't really represent a community. It's always going to be frustrating. It's always going to feel like something that can answer those yearnings. And the minute that that fades, guess what? There's going to be something else being made very salient to you by advertising and marketing that will feel like a substitution for it. And this is what they call terminal materialism, people who have studied this, where you're constantly looking for the answer in the next purchase, and you never quite get there.
Well, what's so fascinating about this phenomenon, and there's a lot being written about it at this point in our history, is that consumers are not unaware of this. And you write about Method soaps, and they make dish soap, and they make hand soap, and some different things. And people that you talked to didn't necessarily care whether the product was any good because they were really into the packaging.
Yeah, they were willing to give it a go. In fact, they expected it not to work, which is fascinating. But they were willing to try it anyway, which, I mean, it shows something about just the fact that we have this kind of sophistication about, or skepticism, if you want to call it that, about how the game works. That doesn't make us immune from the game. And I should say, in defense of Method, that they do say that their customers were, by and large, satisfied with their purchase.
What do you think? I mean, obviously, your work is being read by consumers, and it's being read by people who are selling product.
Yeah.
What do you think those people take away from the research that you've done and the conclusions that you've drawn?
Well, marketers always just want to know. They want me to get to the bottom line and tell them how they can use this to sell more things. I'm personally less interested in that. And the stuff that I get excited about is when I hear from readers who tell me. That what they've taken away from it is that they are rethinking some of the decisions that they make and trying to, I'm not necessarily an advocate of simple living and all that stuff, but I am an advocate of thinking about what you buy before you buy it and making sure that you're not in this kind of reflexive mode where you're, if a sense of community is the thing you're after, if a sense of participation in solving the world's problems is what you're after, there are probably more productive and, in the long run, personally satisfying ways to do that than buying into a particular brand.
As opposed to these sort of knee-jerk decisions that have we been making them forever? Have we been making them since the 90s? When did this become such an issue?
I think we've been making them forever, but I think that the volume keeps going up because there are so many more brands and there is so much more advertising. And I do think that in this 21st century period that we're in, there's been a quantum leap, and it's been exactly because of the new technology that is supposedly setting us free and empowering us. I think it's really, really inspired, if you want to use that word, marketers to find new ways to get themselves into just every conversation and interaction that we're having. And that makes the data set that much more confusing for those of us trying to get through the day.
We have time for a final call, and that comes from David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I had a question. I'm probably maybe the marketer's nightmare because I have money to spend, but I am so turned off by almost all the advertising and the labeling. I mean, to put somebody's name on my shirt that's just a designer. I mean, I want a nice shirt, but I don't want to advertise Tommy or Calvin, or I just want a shirt. And, you know, are we such an oddball to people that just totally reject advertising? Are we a factor? Do they think about us, or do they just not care?
No, they definitely think about you. And the percentage of clothing, particularly if you have money and you're buying high-end shirts, you may not want, of course you don't want to sport a logo, but you probably have some awareness when you're looking at shirts. You probably have some distinction between who Joseph Abboud is and this kind of thing. Or even if you don't, they still are thinking about ways to give you the subtle cues when you are shopping. I mean, a big part of what I'm saying is that your audience for your consumer behavior is not strangers on the street that you're trying to impress with a logo. It's you, you know, and you are the kind of guy who wants a nice shirt. And so it's going to be up to you to figure out what the criteria is for a nice shirt. But of course they're going to try to figure out ways to influence the subtle cues that might tip you toward one shirt over another. Absolutely.
And I guess the fact that David can find a nice shirt without a logo on the outside says somebody's paying attention to what he might want.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we make smarter decisions once we understand this, or do we simply respond in a different way to the information that we have?
I think that you make smarter decisions if you sort of think through, you know, if for example, your issue is you're buying shirts or something, and you, well, what makes a good shirt? And do I care about the material that it's made from, and do I care about the labor conditions? Do I care about the potential environmental impact, or do I just care about style? And do I care about how long it lasts? Do I think that I'll still be wearing this shirt 2 years from now and doesn't matter? I think that there's a lot of usefulness, yeah, to approaching the process that way rather than just sort of saying, hey, that's a nice shirt. I think I'll get it.
Is it frustrating for you having to be hyper aware of these things now? Is it harder than ever to make consumer decisions?
Yeah, well, because of the column, I'm in a constant state of being exposed to new stuff, wanting it very badly for about a week. But then I'm lucky because at the end of the week, I'm usually sick of it and I get to send it back. I mean, I have to send it back. It's part of my job to send it back. So I get the full range.
Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Rob, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Chris, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.